I am Mike Wheeler with Dave Garrison. We've organized the programs for the class of 1965, and so I have the great pleasure of introducing some, and Dave will pull his weight on others as well. I should say, introducing Howard, that Paul Ehrman, our class secretary, gets the finder's fee on this. It was he, Howard, who suggested that we reach out to you, and I'm so thankful that, not for the first time, Paul's been very, very helpful. Let me just read a little bit of Howard's very impressive background. He has taught at SUNY Buffalo, UC Berkeley, as does David Kerp, who will be speaking tomorrow, Columbia, and Yale, where he has chaired the humanities program for a number of years. Howard and I were talking about curricula and what has vanished here and what still may be honored, at least in small ways, in New Haven. He's the author of many books on medieval and modern French literature and history, including one on the Bayeux tapestry 5 or 6 years ago, is that right? Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and is obviously on a very distinguished role there. He first encountered Marcel Proust at Amherst in a course on modern literature with Elmo Giordanati. Am I close? Giordanati. See? Giordanetti, who changed his, meaning Howard's, view of the world. Howard had prepared that bio. What he did not mention is that he is a Sterling professor at Yale. That's named after a person named Sterling, I assume, but also is in recognition of Howard's high quality. It's, I believe, the highest honor that's awarded to a teaching faculty there. So it's a great pleasure to have you back at Amherst, Howard.
Thanks so much. I had written that biography of myself as a kind of preemptive obituary, and Mike had actually lost it, and I was able to retrieve the email and send it to him on the phone in your presence. I hope this doesn't happen at my funeral, because I won't be there to send the message. But anyway. On the evening of September 22, 1961, between the opening class meeting that morning, language placement and fitness tests for college athletics that afternoon, and tryouts for glee club and band later that night, the class of 1965 sat down for the first common intellectual experience of our 4 years at Amherst. We listened to a remarkable lecture by Professor of Political Science George Kateb on what was delicately described by the Freshman Orientation Committee as suggested summer reading. That meant you had to read it. E.M. Foster's Passage to India, one of the best novels of the last century. Professor Kateb urged us to take three things away from Foster's masterwork. One, an appreciation of the way the author uses language. Two, an appreciation of what we could learn from A Passage to India about the contact between two cultures, one Western and one Asian, about the smallness of the modern world, about how the fortunes of all the nations of the globe are tied to each other. Finally, we were encouraged, even before beginning classes at Amherst, to allow this great work of fiction to stretch our imagination. I am not sure myself yet, Kateb concluded, with an openness that performed modestly the very thing of which it spoke. I am not sure myself yet what that is. Now, don't reach for your memory enhancement pharmaceuticals thinking that my memory is better than yours. I actually got the speech from George recently. He had an old onion skin carbon copy, which he sent me. Now, A Passage to India was the ideal book for opening young minds to the possibilities that Amherst held from the outset, and indeed for understanding the Cold War world into which we emerged after graduation. I would like to suggest to you today that Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past is the ideal book for whatever time we have left for reading great works of fiction in the way that people used to turn to religious pursuits in anticipation of a passage to the next world. And I will conclude by returning to Professor Kateb's marvelous intellectual welcome to Amherst with some reflections about liberal education today. The novelist Marcel Proust is fascinating, for his life can be said to contain a triumph of the will by an abdication of the will. Born in 1871, the son of a doctor, he enjoyed a childhood of ease, surrounded by indulgent women, his mother, grandmother, and aunts. In high school, he was an aesthete, founded a literary review, and in what is considered, what he considered to be the greatest military event of all time, Proust did not resist joining the army when the time came for the obligatory 1 year of military service. One look at this picture tells you a little bit why France lost World War I. Now, after the army, Proust plunged into the social life of fin de siècle France. He was interested in high society, names, genealogies, clothes, manners, gossip, and the psychology of those who frequented the salon of Paris's Faubourg Saint-Germain. It was there that he encountered the models that would be incorporated into his novel. Charles Haas or Charles of Frusy, models for Swan, Laure Heyman for Odette, Robert de Montesquieu, the Baron Charlus, Madame Armand de Cavalier for Madame Verdurin. And in this period of living in the world, Proust collected material in long notebooks that he would later transform into the novel narrated in the voice of a combined fictional and autobiographical Marcel, and in which he appears in person only for one moment at a fancy reception in the guise of a novelist who, asked by a disdainful aristocrat, Monsieur de Brayauté, what he is doing there, places a monocle in his eye and responds simply, "J'observe, I am observing." In this early phase of his adulthood, Marcel Proust, the dandy and social gadfly, was observing. Now, the great breaking point in Proust's life occurred around 1898 in the shape of the Dreyfus Affair, which cut him off from many of his aristocratic friends who sided with the army, government, and church against the Jewish colonel who had been falsely accused of revealing military secrets to the Germans. There's actually a common theme between the Guantanamo isolation of prisoners today and the isolation of Dreyfus on Devil's Island for 5 years before his return and rehabilitation. Proust's father died in 1903, his mother in 1905. He describes their death as an exile from childhood, giving him the freedom to write, free from the personal aegis, no longer afraid, parental aegis, no longer afraid of disappointing mom and dad. Proust installed himself in the famous cork-lined room on the Boulevard Haussmann and began his great work at the age of 36. Approaching death, he said, "I began the work of my life. I felt like Noah, closing the doors of the ark." Proust, the recumbent writer, went out rarely. He was cared for by his housekeeper, Celeste. He received friends occasionally, often to ask them this or that detail about the outside world. He worked all night and slept in the day. In that heady time of literary life in Paris, Proust once met James Joyce at a midnight supper. Joyce asked Proust if he liked truffles. Proust asked Joyce if he knew the Duchess so-and-so. Joyce then concluded that they had nothing to say to each other because his day was over just as Proust's day began. In the years Proust spent in his room or in bed, he transformed the notebooks he had compiled while living in the world into a work of art. The first part, Swan's Way, appeared in 1913, 100 years ago last year. A year before. He had written the end, Time Regained, at the outbreak of World War I, but he was prevented from publishing during the war years, and he thus expanded the middle volumes to a combined 3,200 pages. In a sentence, and there's an old Monty Python routine which you tell the story of the 3,200 pages in 30 seconds, but in one sentence, Remembrance of Things Past is the story of the search for an absolute, a paradise on earth, through conventional means, love, ambition, money, social prestige, only to discover salvation through art, which alone makes us feel whole, or at least part of a world bigger and better than ourselves, if not a little bit immortal. Proust won the prestigious Prix Goncourt in 1919 and kept writing, sacrificing in his words his body on the altar of artistic creation. He raced against time to finish his task in his own words, the transfusion of his blood into the veins of his characters. Proust died in 1922, shortly after finishing. Now, time is the great topic of Proust's novel, and this from the very first sentence. Longtemps, je me suis couché de bonne heure. For a long time, I went to bed early. A novel has to contain everything in the first sentence, like an egg, an embryo, which will develop into what follows. And here, the two great structuring poles of remembrance of things past, that of time and of the subject narrator, are held in the very first two words, longtemps, for a long time, je, I. That the first two words should contain in Nietzsche the rest is a deeply Proustian principle. The great cultural critic, Roland Barthes, remarked that in reading Proust, one never skips the same passages twice. This is not because one wants that's not because one wants to read Proust quickly or to skim, but because it doesn't matter where you begin and where you end. The whole is contained in each of its parts. As in Freudian psychology, where even the smallest of events, slips of the tongue, free association, shadow memories, are clues to deeper psychic meaning, each phrase in Proust, each word, is significant. The beginning of Remembrance of Things Past depicts a drifting asleep, which is in fact an awakening in the Platonic mode upon a different plane of consciousness, a reincarnation. Sometimes my candle slightly out, scarcely out, my eyes would come so quickly, would close so quickly, that I did not have time to say to myself, I am falling asleep. And half an hour later, the thought that it was time to try to sleep would wake me. I wanted to put down the book I thought I still had in my hands and blow out my light. I had not ceased while sleeping to form reflections on what I had just read. But these reflections had taken a rather peculiar turn. It seemed to me that I myself was what the book was talking about. A church, a quartet, the rivalry between Francois I and Charles V. This belief lived on for a few seconds after my waking. It did not shock my reason, but lay heavy like scales on my eyes and kept them from realizing that the candlestick was no longer lit. Then it began to grow unintelligible to me, as after metempsychosis to the thoughts of an earlier existence. The subject of the book detached itself from me. I was free to apply myself to it or not. Immediately I recovered my sight, and I was amazed to find a darkness around me, soft and restful for my eyes, but perhaps even more so for my mind, to which it appeared a thing without cause, incomprehensible, a thing truly dark. We take from this passage a sense of Proust's hypersensibility, his close observation of himself, of consciousness in relation to itself, and of the external world, of the lack of separation between the narrator and the book, which becomes the paradigm of a lack of separation between the perceiving subject and the object of perception. We also take from it a first taste of the Proustian long sentence, that trait of style characteristic of the long novel, which is, in some deep sense, one long sentence, a poetic one at that. Remembrance of Things Past is a long prose poem. Somebody said In Search of Lost Time is lost time for other people who are reading it, but it's not true. The Proustian sentence disorients the reader, who is engulfed in its twists and folds, its subordinations, hypotheses, apostrophes, authorial asides, detours, circlings, and delayed points. If you know the novels of Proust's contemporary, Henry James, you recognize a certain affinity with the reticulated Jamesian sentence. Proust's own dedication to deferral is contained in the long sentence that makes us wait for its meaning, which also may be a principle of composition. The author did not write Remembrance of Things Past in a straightforward, linear fashion, but in a multi-layered, intensely rehearsed, redacted way, as we can see by the corrections to the last page. This is the last sentence, and this is the last sentence, which, as he wrote it out by hand and corrected it. I'll read. If you just were given this and had to set it in type, you might have a very difficult time. If at least time enough were allotted to me to accomplish my work, I would not fail to mark it with the seal of time, the idea of which imposed itself upon me with so much force today. And I would therein describe men, if need be, as monsters occupying a place in time, simultaneously touching widely separated years and the distant periods they have lived through, between which so many days have ranged themselves, they stand like giants immersed in time. From longtemps, the first word, to temps, the last, remembrance of things past is circled by time. And this process continued until the very end, as you can see from this page of corrected galley proofs, in which this was the book already printed, but he kept writing it even as the thing was going into print for publication. A lot of these pages are actually held in Beinecke's in the Beinecke Library at Yale. With Proust, it doesn't matter where you're located within the world of conventional syntax, that is, within the world of logic, of causality, within an expository mode of actions, events, or ideas. The imagination escapes the linearity of cause and effect, the half-light of the bedroom appearing as a thing without cause, incomprehensible, a thing truly dark. One can be anywhere, for consciousness is a great reservoir in which every moment is latent in every other, just as the whole of the novel is present in every phrase, every clause, every sentence, the last word in the first. The great English modernist T.S. Eliot expresses a similar idea in the Brent Norton section of the Four Quartets from 1936, but with a very different conclusion. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. Eliot was a great depressive, I think. The simultaneity of past, present, and future is for Eliot a source of despair, while for Proust, all time is redeemable along a great continuum in which perception, sensation, and projection, daydream, memory, and rational thought are fungible, commingle with each other, and are recuperable in words. Proust is not so concerned about the future, but all past is available in the present. This, indeed, is how the novel is structured. A man of approximately 40 remembers many years before tasting a bit of cake, Madeleine, dipped in tea, and is carried by involuntary memory back to his childhood. And soon, mechanically, dispirited after a dreary day with the prospect of a depressing morrow, I raised to my lips a spoonful of the tea in which I had soaked a morsel of the cake. No sooner had the warm liquid mixed with the crumbs touched my palate than a shudder ran through me and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary thing that was happening to me. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses, something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origins. And at once the vicissitudes of life had become indifferent to me, its disasters innocuous, its brevity illusory, this new sensation having had on me the effect which love has of filling me with a precious essence. Or rather, this essence was not in me, it was me. I had ceased now to feel mediocre, contingent, mortal. The taste was that of the little piece of Madeleine, which on Sunday mornings at Combray, because of those mornings I did not go out before Mass, when I went to say good morning to her in her bedroom, my Aunt Léonie used to give me, dipping it first in her own cup of tea or tisane. And here is a picture of the Wikipedia Madeleine, just, if you want to know what that piece of cake looked like, just suppurating with butter. The co-presence of two moments, the experience and the memory, lifts Marcel outside of time, above time, gives him a glimpse, a sensation, an intimation of immortality, to borrow Wordsworth's title. I had ceased to feel mediocre, contingent, mortal. The rest of the novel is the story of what has happened between these two moments, neither of which in and of itself is particularly remarkable, but which combined produce a feeling of divinity. The novel, which circles back upon itself like a memory of the Madeleine in tea, which is more than just a personal memory, lifting the narrator outside of time, it provides access to being itself, to what Proust terms the inner book of unknown symbols. Such a privileged moment of involuntary memory coincides with the discovery that art might reproduce this feeling, and the revelation after a lifetime of ineffective, dissipated, disparate searchings in the world of people and things of the vocation of the writer. Remembrance of things past is, like Augustine's Confessions, a conversion narrative, the story of passing through a series of worldly attachments on the way to salvation, not via God, but via art. Now, the first of these is social. and features the world of the Salon of Belle Époque, France. A closed community with its own internal rules, Madame Verdurin's salon, which the character Charles Swann enters and from which is then expulsed, is the locus of literary and philosophical discussion among like-minded persons for whom such a gathering each night is also a sign of social distinction. Proust portrays in the nightly gatherings in the salon of a high bourgeois house like that of Monsieur and Madame Verdurin, the nightlife of the 20% of the population of pre-World War I France, known as rentiers, those who didn't work but lived off of their rents. The Verdurin never invited you to dinner. You had at their house a place set for you. The salon possesses an internal vocabulary with an anthropological and even a religious ring. It is a little set, a little circle, a little clan. Proust speaks of new recruits, a little church, the faithful, and of comrades. In this hothouse atmosphere of the salon, Madame Verdurin rules like a grand inquisitor, extirpating heresies. One doesn't refuse invitations, one doesn't wear evening attire, one always agrees with the hostess. You had to abide tacitly by a credo, one of whose articles was that the young pianist patronized by Madame Verdurin that year, of whom she would say it ought to be against the law to be able to play Wagner like that, was miles above both Plante and Rubinstein, and that Dr. Cotard was a better diagnostician than Potin. Snobism, Proust notes, of which St. Paul must have been thinking when he spoke of a sin without remission, works to constitute a community of sorts. One takes one's identity from the exclusion of others in a self-acknowledged superiority over them. In this world divided between the moitié of the faithful and the bores and the nuisances, which is to say everyone else, one values oneself in function of the devaluation of others. And at an extreme, the little clan, like some primitive tribe, renews itself through exclusion, those it keeps out, and scapegoating, a sacrificial rite of expulsion. Swann learns this lesson the hard way. He is exposed for spending time with aristocrats instead of high bourgeois. He lunches with the President of the Republic, Monsieur Grévy, and has friends of which he has not spoken. He is reserved, arrives late, leaves early, creating the impression of having a life outside of the salon. Swann is a shifter, moving up and down the social scale. He did not enclose himself in the edifice of his relationships. The identity of the little clan is threatened by Swann, who commits the effrontery of reminding them of the existence of other little clans. Now, love is the second great worldly attachment, and when it comes to love, Swann is a professional. The career of lover has displaced all others, that is to say, his calling as an art historian, writing a study of Vermeer. And this has developed into merely advising society ladies about how to decorate their homes. Swann was so fond of women that once he had come to know more or less all the women in aristocratic circles, and they had nothing more to teach him, he frequents some little provincial hole or obscure circle of Paris where the daughter of a squire or clerk had struck him as pretty. Swann's obsessional pursuit of women, up and down the social scale, his Don Juanism, is the sure sign that he does not actually love the women he pursues. In fact, Swann is incapable of loving a woman in and of herself. The woman with whom he becomes obsessed, Odette de Crécy, had seemed to Swann not without beauty, certainly, but of a type of beauty that left him indifferent. That aroused no desire in him, even caused him a sort of physical repulsion. Why on earth, you may ask, does Swann get involved with a woman whom he finds neither beautiful nor desirable? The answer lies in the realm of art. Swann's love is born, first, through music. Music heard in her presence that lifts him out of time and transforms what began as physical repulsion into attraction. Swann's life is energized by painting. Swann's love is energized by painting, which supplements music. Standing next to him, she struck Swann by her resemblance to the figure of Zipporah, Jethro's daughter, in a fresco in the Sistine Chapel. Swan had always had this peculiar penchant for amusing himself by rediscovering in the paintings of the masters not only the general characteristics of the real world that surrounds us, but what seems, on the contrary, the least susceptible to generalization, the individual features of the faces we know. Now, there's something of the Platonist in Proust. Love and the aesthetic are entwined. Swan loves Odette only insofar as he recognizes in her a type of beauty more perfectly glimpsed in Botticelli's painting, which makes us understand the final phrase of Swan in love. To think that I have wasted years of my life, that I wanted to die, that I felt my deepest love for a woman who did not appeal to me, who was not my type. You know, this is all you would be surprised. I teach the history of the Western canon. You would be surprised how many books are about midlife crises. I only tell you this because we're beyond that now. And but you know, beginning if you begin with Dante, you know, who finds himself in midlife, Don Quixote is the same thing, and right on through to Proust. Now, there's something of the Platonist in Proust. Love and the aesthetic are entwined. Swan loves Odette only insofar as he recognizes in her a type of beauty more perfectly glimpsed in Botticelli's painting, which makes us understand this final phrase. Now, we're not to wonder that Odette was not Swan's type. No woman could possibly be a man's type. I tell this to my undergraduates. I say, you know, we appreciate great works of literature for their beauty and their truth, I said, but it's all self-help. And if you start to love someone who you think is a type, you're on the wrong track. Find someone who's lovable and for themselves rather than a type. It won't change anyone's decisions ultimately, but but I'm here to tell you that no woman could possibly be a man's type, since as long as one loves a type and not an individual, the individual will always be disappointing. Swan's love is from the start perversely predicated upon a confusion of individuals and type. It would have had no purchase upon his soul, however, were it not for that moment when, in every such attachment, the reality of an individual bumps up against the ideal via the inevitable arrival of jealousy. Jealousy is the great catalyst to love. Swan is rather indifferent to Odette until one fatal evening when he arrives at the Verdurin's house so late that Odette, thinking he would not be coming, had already left. When he saw that she was no longer in the drawing room, Swan felt a pain in his heart. He trembled at being deprived of a pleasure that he was now measuring for the first time. Attempting to chase down Odette after not finding her where she was supposed to be, Swan finally experiences desire. He was obliged to acknowledge that he himself was no longer the same, and that he was no longer alone, that a new person was there with him, attached to him, amalgamated to him, one from whom he might not be able to free himself, whom he was going to have to treat with circumspection like a master or an illness. And love is described from then on as an illness, and Swan, as Proust says, from this moment on, was inoperable. From that moment on, Swan is obsessed by an anxious need whose object is the person himself, an absurd need which the laws of this world make it impossible to satisfy and difficult to cure, the senseless and painful need to possess another. The desire for possession places Swan in thraldom. It alters the proportions of his soul. Like a deadly virus, it mutates. The disease that had broken out in him takes the form of an insatiable desire to know. If he only knew more, Swan thinks, he would be satisfied. But since there is no way of knowing fully the soul of another person, he remains attached to, obsessed by, what he doesn't know, which is another way of saying that as long as one thinks one loves a person, when in fact one seeks an ideal, one is always jealous of something and bound to be disappointed. What we take from one of the greatest stories of Western romantic love is, first, that erotic desire is mimetic. It's a rapport between three terms, the lover, the beloved, and an aesthetic object, or between the lover, the beloved, and a rival, whether that rival is real or imaginary. One of the lessons learned from the story of Swann's obsession with a woman who was not even his type has to do with how little what we love or desire is a function of the thing itself and how much it is a function of what we perceive to be the love or the desire or the esteem of others. The more we think others want something or someone, the more desirable that thing or that person becomes for us. All love triangles function according to this principle, as do most social groupings in which one senses hierarchies of belonging and exclusion to which one aspires or which one seeks to avoid. Auctions and financial markets work on the same principle of mimetic desire, as values rise and fall in proportion to how much we think potential buyers will want, that is, will pay for the stock, commodity, or other vehicle at some time in the future. Mimetic desire is the bread and butter of marketing, the advertising industry that came into being around the time of Proust's writing. The second lesson of Swann in Love is the subjective nature of experience, Proust's so-called mentalism. Proust was an avid reader and indeed a translator of John Ruskin, from whom he says he learned how to look closely at things, that art is more real than life, and that the subject of art is not important. To show you how unimportant it is, Proust wrote a beautiful sentence about the most base thing that you might have imagined, which is the effect of asparagus on the smell of your urine. And this is right at the moment of the Eshkan school of art too, where you know people were turning to abject objects in order to make art out of them. The mind, the imagination, are stronger than reality, which is always disappointing. Thus the famous Proustian dictum, the only paradise is a lost paradise. Remembrance of things past is the history of the discovery, however, of a paradise within, a novel in which it can be said that nothing happens really. A man goes to sleep as he does each night. He remembers when his mother fed him a piece of cake dipped in tea, the first of a series of involuntary memories of childhood and of a world of socially insignificant figures who, without his observation and art, would have disappeared without a trace. Resurrection through art is the only thing that offsets our disappointments with experience. The West has been haunted ever since the early modern period by what the sociologist Max Weber terms a disenchantment with the world, a sense that in the absence of religion, our reality is out of sync with all ideals. The greatest thinkers and creators of the 19th century are haunted by the displacedness or the belatedness of experience. Does it ever happen to you, Natasha asks Nicholas in Tolstoy's epic masterpiece, War and Peace, does it ever happen to you to feel as if there were nothing more to come, nothing, that everything good is past, and to feel not exactly dull, but sad? The 19th century suffers from a mal du siècle, a sickness of the century, the feeling of exhaustion, a sense not of global warming, but of global entropy, fatigue. The poet Arthur Rimbaud speaks of Europe's bad blood. The flesh is weak, alas, and I have read all the books, writes the poet Stéphane Mallarmé, who died in 1898. Now, Proust doesn't lament the difference between a past imagined as more intense and a deflated present, for memory holds the key to renewal. It has the power to resurrect a past which never truly dies, which continues to reside within us. For Proust, memory is not only consoling. The summoning of the past is a proof of a constancy of the self that takes us outside of ourselves. Such moments carry us to a world of laws and ideas. They cure our false searchings and alienations by making us feel part of a larger and more meaningful world. And then, after I had dwelt for some little time upon these resurrections of the memory, the thought came to me that in another fashion, certain obscure impressions had solicited my attention in a fashion somewhat similar to these reminiscences, except that they concealed within them not a sensation dating from an earlier time, but a new truth. As if our finest ideas were like tunes which come back to us, although we have never heard them before, and which we have to make an effort to hear and transcribe. I had the feeling that perhaps beneath these signs there lay something of a quite different kind which I must try to discover. for the truths which the intellect apprehends directly in the world of full and unimpeded light have something less profound, less necessary than those which life communicates to us against our will in an impression which is material because it enters us through the senses, but yet has a spiritual meaning which it is possible for us to extract. In fact, the task was to interpret the given sensations as signs of so many laws and ideas by trying to think, that is to say, to draw forth from the shadow what I had merely felt by trying to convert it into its spiritual equivalent. And this method, which seemed the sole method, what was it but the creation of a work of art? Proust realizes, of course, that neither Swann nor his readers are capable of creating a work of art. Neither are artists or writers. Here, the conclusion of Remembrance of Things Past articulates nicely with Professor Kateb's advice to us on the night of September 22, 1961, when he said, "Perhaps only a very few can ever hope to write as Foster writes." But there, his novel is a model of a certain kind of perfection, even though we cannot hope to attain perfection. Without these models, we would be worse off than we are. Now, you will remember that, of course, professors say that to humiliate their students. You will remember something that happened 50 years ago, 54 years ago. You will remember, of course, that Professor Kateb concluded his inaugural talk to the class of 1965, and this you may remember, because it's the only thing I really remember, with the advice to travel light. Rid yourself of the baggage of likes and dislikes. Rid yourself of the baggage of silly conventions that choke life. Be careful before you take on any encumbrance so that you can receive the full force of things. The passage to which Kateb referred, in A Passage to India, occurs after one of the main characters, Cyril Fielding, a colonial school principal in Chandrapur, is getting to know Dr. Aziz in what is an unusual, if not socially prohibited, intimacy between an Englishman and an Indian. Aziz has warned Fielding about speaking too openly and frankly about his religious beliefs. "Thanks for telling me that. Yes, I must try to be more careful," Fielding replies. "If I'm interested, I'm apt to forget myself. Still, it doesn't do real harm. But speaking out may get you into trouble. It's often done so in the past. There, listen to that. But the end of it might be that you lost your job. If I do, I do. I shall survive it. I travel light." "Travel light? You're a most extraordinary race," said Aziz, turning away as if he were going to sleep and immediately turning back again. "Is it your climate or what? Plenty of Indians travel light too, sadhus and such. It's one of the things I admire about your country. Any man can travel light until he has a wife or children." Professor Kateb didn't share that secret with us. No. The phrase "travel light" is synonymous with being unmarried, unsettled, unencumbered, as yet uninvested in the future. Fielding, having left for England, later returns to India married. He did not travel as lightly as in the past. Education was a continuous concern to him because his income and the comfort of his family depended on it. He knew that few Indians think education a good in itself, and he deplored this now on the widest grounds. "We were unsettled in the summer of 1961 and could afford to travel light. Whether now married or not, whether with children or not, most of us in the intervening years have become encumbered by our commitments. We have become fixed in our ways, settled in our saucers, in the French phrase. So what are we now to take from visiting A Passage to India and encountering, however quickly, Proust's long masterpiece about the virtues of slow living?" An answer to this question has to do with listening to what Proust calls the call of art. Even if we are incapable of creating a work, we are capable of listening, seeing, reading, of introspection, and of harnessing the imagination to whatever task is at hand. Remembrance of Things Past is a work for all our ages, moving as it does from the magic and sufferings of childhood to Swann and midlife crisis to the wisdom that comes with the ripeness of years. I recommend to undergraduates that they read it three times in their lives. a first time amidst all the coursework, musical, dramatic, political, and athletic activities of college life, a first reading that is always too little and too fast. I advise them to revisit Proust in middle age, for sooner or later we all find that the solidity of our daily habits and the attainments of our worldly ambitions may leave us with a longing for something more spiritual. It may be too late for us to read Proust in full midlife crisis, but you can pick up Remembrance of Things Past in or near retirement and read it slowly with the maturity of experience in preparation for what is to come. Proust's sense of wonder at the world, his delight in the smallest sensation, his portraits of people and of nature, his rendering of the full range of human emotions, makes us feel, in his own phrase, the joy of rediscovering what is real. I conclude with a passage from George Keteb's marvelous lecture on A Passage to India, which may be even more important than his concluding counsel to travel light. Starting here. Yeah. But you may ask, Keteb asks, how can Amherst be India? How can coming to Amherst from some American town or city be like going to an exotic and faraway land? Amherst is in America. Amherst is a school. It is not a large, hot land that holds within itself a multitude of contradictions or that sets up natural and social barriers of every kind to movement, to contact, to friendship, to knowledge. Amherst is pretty. Amherst is easy. Amherst is pleasure. What's the connection between Amherst and the Asiatic chaos? A phrase one couldn't use today. I would say right off that if, after you get through with Amherst 4 years from now, and find that all that Amherst has been is pleasure, that it's just been a pretty place, that life as it was by and large was easy, then Amherst has involved you in a scandalous failure. Part of the blame will rest with Amherst, but it is equally certain that part of the blame will rest with you. Of course, Amherst, literally speaking, is not India, is not Asiatic chaos, but unless Amherst is a place of difficulty and anxiety for you, unless Amherst tests you and changes you, unless Amherst occasionally scares you, then Amherst is a failure. And if Amherst can do these things to and for you, and you choose to ignore Amherst, if you don't come, to use Professor Godbole's word, when Amherst calls you, then you are a failure, and liberal education is an expensive and immoral fraud. I think, as an initial belief, that Amherst can provide you with all sorts of experiences, from the most lonely to the most unsettling, just as India provided these experiences for Fielding, Mrs. Moore, and other characters in Forster's novel. The burden, then, is on you to engage yourselves with Amherst and let Amherst do with its work on you. But if you resist Amherst out of cowardice or out of a love for ease, then you will have done something terribly wrong, wrong to Amherst, and much more important, wrong to yourselves. We have, of course, changed, having lived more than half a lifetime since listening to those words. But Amherst, along with liberal education in America, may have changed even more. From the coherent, well-thought-out curriculum, which urged us even before English 1-2 began to learn to use language accurately and effectively, Amherst has embraced an open curriculum known for its complete innocence of any knowledge of curricular requirements. From a place meant to challenge us in ways that were anxious-making and even scary, not only Amherst, but colleges all over the land are now designed to make students' experiences as non-threatening and comfortable as possible. Witness recent media attention to in-class trigger warnings before encountering material that might make some students feel emotionally uneasy. When it comes to the myriad of social and psychological services available on most college campuses, one is put in mind of assisted living for young people. What can be done? Nothing more than the liberal arts colleges in the United States, which are the envy of the world, and which now have made terrific headway with Amherst in the lead toward the goal of demographic diversity and affordability, now began to think more seriously about what it offers educationally to an incredibly talented and diverse student body. This means, in my view, some version of a common curriculum that would make a community out of the student body and faculty, and that is also adequate to the global needs of the 21st century. a study of literature, history, and political theory, and philosophy from around the world, alongside the science of the West, since science is, for the moment, a Western undertaking, though it hasn't always been that way in the past. Such a curriculum would consist of courses in things like comparative social institutions, current issues, foundations of science, integrated science, science inquiry, historical analysis, literature and humanities, modern social thought, philosophy and social thought, and quantitative reasoning. That's a challenge for the faculty to put together, the few of the faculty who are here today. Since a more detailed version of such a curriculum has been sent to the trustees, president, dean, committee of six of Amherst, and distributed to our class as well as to other classes, I won't dwell on it more than to say that such an understanding of what liberal education would, could, and should be is not an add-on to practical, scientific, technical, or economic vocational training, a supplement to a more directly profitable course of study when times are good, a luxury or a pleasure when or pleasurable virtue when times are bad. Containing, in the phrase of Benjamin Franklin, a wealth of useful knowledge, the liberal arts are the most meaningful and practical thing we can offer college students today, a way of understanding the increasingly complex and global world in which students graduating today will act and move. From the litany of lost fortunes found in fiction, we can discover the tools necessary for assessing our motivations and character, along with the motivation and character of others. The novel is a tremendous reservoir of observation of human behavior. Rightly understood, there's no better tool for survival in a world that, despite scientific and technological advances, still functions according to modes of action and reaction that are psychological and not technical, matters not of metrics, but of interest and alertness, perspective and perception, assessment and belief. As a catalyst to the imagination, the novel teaches keen awareness of our surroundings and caution before appearances that may or may not be illusory. Reading is a way of vicariously testing alternative modes of understanding and of engaging in unfamiliar gambits in unknown spheres. Philosophy, political philosophy, moral philosophy, deal with ethical judgment, right action, and finally, how to strike a balance between our own needs and desires and our obligation to others. Thinkers from Plato and Aristotle to the makers of our own modernity, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and Mill, have addressed the place of money in fundamental human relations, the role of the state in regulating markets, the unlimited accumulation of property versus a more socialized distribution of wealth, the effects of taxation in any such arrangement, whether man is born morally good and is corrupted by society, or is born to a state of natural competition and disorder. Now, I have no illusions about presidential candidates, senators, or congressmen reading widely in the liberal arts. However, in a globalized world, reading the classics, not only of our tradition, but of China, India, Buddhism, and Islam, is a strategic way of understanding the culture and modes of thought of the people whose minds may be as important to troops on the ground as guns and drones. "You must never invade a country, Mr. President," the late Norman Mailer addressed John Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs in the spring before he arrived at Amherst. "You must never invade a country, Mr. President, without understanding the music of its people." What an exaggeration, but the poetry there, you know, makes you feel young again. With the disappearance of education in preparation of political classes and with the speed of global decision-making in the atomic age, our leaders seem not to have time to read or reflect, with the result that they do not form concepts, think in terms of relationships, contextualize or internalize, nor do they seem to have a sense that we've been here or somewhere like here before. The liberal arts offer a wealth of precedent, a wide spectrum of options about essential economic, political, and strategic questions. It may seem slow compared to the quick technological or military fix, but they work to develop powers of discernment and decision. They tender a concentrated testing of when and when not to act and how, of what has worked and not worked and under what conditions in the past, and of the significance of such testings for the future. At the least, we learn from history about the unlikely chances we have of beating certain historical cycles and odds. The liberal arts provide the terrain and terms by which our intentions, interests, passions, and commitments, personal and collective, are to be understood and weighed. The time has never been better. The question of what humanity is, both as a description and a virtue, is all the more acute as the emerging technologies of robotics, genetics, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and animal communication blur traditional boundaries between what is human and what is not. In an increasingly globalized and connected world, the humanities portion of the liberal arts offer a vision of that which is common to mankind. Despite the recent history of indifference to that communality in our universities, and here I'm thinking of identity politics in the way that they have structured universities and made groups of students in which only someone who belongs to a particular group can speak for that group or has the right to speak or in the name of that group. Everyone has the right to speak and no one listens. Almost every culture shares in musical forms that include collective and individual instrumental performance, lament, song, and dance, visual artifacts that include two-dimensional representation, sculpture, and architecture, literature that includes some version of lyric, epic, novel, or romance, and theatrical performance. Philosophy may be more problematic and a function of systems of broad and efficient social organization, but the place and questions of philosophy are taken up elsewhere by religion, which becomes its own interesting question. There is no culture that does not have some way of recounting its past, whether oral or written, legend or chronicle, universal history or local record, official charter or journal entry account. The great works, I won't say of the Western condition, but of the human tradition, enduring artifacts that transcend a particular time and place and that continue to move listeners, viewers, and readers through time are the centripetal points around which a human community coalesces and through which it recognizes that which is most explicitly human. Thank you. I usually only leave 30 seconds for my students to ask questions, but we do have a few minutes for questions. Is that right, Tom? Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So we're good till 2, so make your questions brief, please, and I'm going to ask you to repeat them if you would.
Okay.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
You referred to a document that had been transmitted to the college and to the class, but I haven't received a copy. Are we all going to get copies?
Sam, let me, I referred, the question is a document sent to our class. Sam, do you, yeah.
I'm happy to send you a copy. Anyone who wants a copy of the strategic plan response that some of our classmates put together, just see me and I'm happy to send
it. Could we do it just on general distribution? Do I have anybody email?
Well, we didn't do that. I did mail to everybody in the class. We tried to get a class list from the college, which was unavailable, and I used all the emails that I could possibly find.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's absolutely no secret. We tried to distribute as widely as possible with Sam being the point person.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
If you didn't get one, you would like one this evening.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lou. Yeah.
So while Bruce was living before he started writing, there was a tremendous revolution in art and science
right.
that took place at the end of the 19th century. Especially, you know, with regard to Einstein and the theory of relativity and how that affected people's thinking about time
sure.
back then. And Picasso was very
absolutely cubist painting is right in there. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot going on there, and some of that was also there was an important French component to that.
Poincaré, Henri Poincaré, absolutely, yeah.
Einstein, but I wonder whether. Association with Poincaré?
Well, he knew Poincaré. I don't know whether he knew him personally, but it certainly knew of him. But the big influence there was his cousin, Henri Bergson, the philosopher who had a great... You know, this begins as a technological question, as they began to be able to measure time with greater precision, everyone was starting to think that they might get down to some kind of something like time simultaneity. And the big influence here, I'm convinced, is fast film, which in the 1880s gave you a shutter speed of up to 750th of a second. And suddenly they saw things in terms of facial expressions and bodily movements that they never seen before. And of course, the great movement there is the movies. The Lumiere brothers made a first fortune in fast film and a second fortune in the movies in 1895 and 6 when they were the first movies. And so there was a great sense of time simultaneity. And the reviews that came out after the first movie showing in Paris at the end of 1895, the first critic said, "The movies are fantastic. They will reverse time. You will be immortal. You will never die. You will be able to attend the wedding of your grandmother." Because the thought was that making the individual shot into a seamless motion had triumphed over time. And there are huge movements there, and certainly cubism with the seeing of a single object from multiple points of view, which we learned in physics was impossible. Yeah, absolutely. And relativity, relativity is right in there. And in 1905, with relativity, of course, these things were perking in the past. Einstein, who was self-taught, actually, as a physicist, couldn't get a job, came up with that in 1905. But that stuff had been circulating scientifically right in the zones of Proust. And of course, Freud's model of the mind and the unconscious, which is just a reservoir of memories of the past, which can be brought to conscious attention, is another version of that preserving of the past. A lot of things come together right at that time. And, speed becomes a huge theme and in art. And Proust urges us to slow down, but he does have that sense of making time just a mental plastic concept. Like Einstein saying, if a man is in moving around the Earth in orbit, it's not the man. You can't tell whether it's the man who's moving or the Earth is moving. They're just moving relative to each other. Yeah.
No, he put forward the idea that you really can't tell.
Right.
If you're in a gravityless situation, if you jump, you can't tell.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So Howard, we're talking about time.
Yeah.
It was 54 years ago that we sat in Johnson Chapel and heard K-Tech.
Right.
You have brought us back there in a way that reflects the very best of the Amherst.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.